and gave a list of the reasons why the Middle East was becoming anti-American. And one of them was, and this is a Department of State quote, one of the reasons was a sincere objection to America's part in Palestine developments. So by 1950, the United States is well aware of what its involvement in the region is doing. And so the blueprint is already in place for this expanded role. And then you see, you know, in rapid fire, you see events like Suez in 1956. In 1953, you saw the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then you have the overthrow of revolution led by Karim Qasim. 1958, there's an intervention in Lebanon to try to actually, at that point, prop up Kamil Kamoun, and so on. So the United States is increasingly involved. And within those areas, you start to see the development of indigenous resistance. In 1960, inside southern Vietnam, the anti-American, let's call them that for a moment, forces established the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam. And then in 1964, the PLO was established. Something interesting, too, is the idea of, for want of a better term, geographical legitimacy. The United States will always say that, and Ken Burns and liberals say this today still, that North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam. The resistance really was in the South. The North clearly had, was run by the Communist Party of Vietnam. Most of the Southern resistance were people who were Southerners. You know, the U.S. would say they were outsiders and they were, you know, trained in the North to go into the South and so forth. The vast majority, almost the entire resistance in Southern Vietnam was Southern. These are people who had fought with the Viet Minh, they fought against the French, and they remained there. For the most part, the resistance in Southern Vietnam was indigenous. Right. And we hear this all the time, this trope of outsiders coming in and creating problems with regard to the PLO in Palestine. We know that it's an indigenous movement based on these really longstanding developments. But the same thing happens in Vietnam, too. You would continue to hear this, you know, they invaded us kind of stuff. But the reality is, first, there really weren't two Vietnams. One was just artificially invented. And the reality was that the Vietnamese fighting in the South, trying to get rid of the government, were actually Southerners themselves. And, you know, when I started to understand politics later than the 60s, but not much, two of the people who were often lauded and linked together were Ho Chi Minh and Yasser Arafat, you know, as well as Castro and Che and Nelson Mandela and others. But Ho and Arafat were always lauded on the left as part of the same struggle. And, you know, you don't have to be a communist to understand the importance of those third world revolutions. They gave each other support, but it was also important to have countries like the Soviet Union and China with regard to these smaller places because they had what they saw as some protection. They had a little bit of cover, which I think is one of the biggest differences today because Palestine's isolated in ways that Vietnam never was. Vietnam fought on its own. It had an amazing military, but it also got significant levels of support and aid from countries like the Soviet Union and China, whereas obviously today in Gaza, there's nothing like that, and the other Arab states are not involved in ways really at all, right? But those liberation movements in the 60s were really crucial. Okay, the United States, you know, it always has this rhetoric, we were born of revolution, all that kind of stuff. The United States despised these revolutionary movements. Inside Vietnam, the United States began fighting a massive war. Vietnam is obviously much bigger than Gaza, but neither of these are big, massive, huge countries, right? Inside Vietnam, the United States began to employ massive firepower. Inside the military, there was actually a great deal of resistance to the Vietnam War because, you know, these generals and admirals said, we're preparing to fight against the Soviet Union in Europe. I mean, the idea of using B-52s, which are these massive bombers, they can saturate an area with one flight, one sortie of 1 by 2 square miles. The idea of using B-52s in Vietnam was considered crazy by Air Force generals, yet they did it. The United States established free fire zones, search and destroy missions. They deforested entire areas with herbicides, napalm, Agent Orange, white phosphorus was used broadly. If you were to put together a list of the kinds of things the United States did, it would match with great you know, synchronicity, what's happening today with Israel, the United States in Vietnam, especially in the later years of the war after Nixon took over in 1969, began to attack the North more vigorously, which included bombing schools, civilian centers, hospitals, and so forth. Very similar to today. The biggest difference, though, is the DRV, and as I mentioned before, had the capacity to fight back much more strongly. It had received a great deal of military equipment from the Chinese and the Soviet Union, especially. It had surface-to-air missiles, which it used with great effect. In the famous Christmas bombings of 1972, Nixon claimed that the United States bombed Vietnam so badly they came back and negotiated, right? The reality is actually quite different. The Vietnamese and the Christmas bombings shot down an estimated 34 B-52s. And then I forgot what they cost each, but it was the United States took significant losses in Vietnam. One thing I'd be curious, this is what Israel's lost in Palestine, in Gaza today, right? Because we do see those videos. We saw those quite a bit where Israeli tanks are being blown up and sabotaged. And remember, in both of these places, you have similar wars. You have these kind of guerrilla wars going on, too, these partisans. So I think that's kind of important to understand, too. So the United States is just destroying Vietnam, right? A small country, which, you know, the world was really aghast at that, but didn't really do much about it. Again, very similar, right? The United States would establish what they call free fire zones, where everybody in the area was considered Viet Cong. The war in large measure was based on, the success was based on body counts. How many of the enemy did you kill? And the old saying was, if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's a VC. Older people, kids, buffalo, right? So the United States is racking up these huge body counts because it's just destroying everything in sight. The United States displaced villagers. It created a strategic hamlet program in the early 60s where they took people away from the villages where they'd been living. People who had lived there, their ancestral homes, their ancestral graveyards, and so forth, they removed them and put them into these strategic hamlets, which were referred to at the time as concentration camps. So there is a forced dispossession of people in Vietnam, too. So, and the one thing to keep in mind is it's what I'm seeing today is horrific. It's chilling. I haven't seen anything like this, really, since the Vietnam era. But it's not unique. This is the way empires, and clearly the way the United States does things, right? It included massacres. We've probably all heard of My Lai. My Lai occurred pretty regularly, and more stuff has come out about that now. There was a force called Tiger Battalion that would go around in its area of operations and just kill entire villages. My Lai is the best known. In My Lai, I think 400 people were killed in that particular day, and we're probably familiar with it, where American soldiers just went in, literally, you know, filled ditches up and killed people and raped women. It was horrific, right? In that same region, in March of 1969, the United States killed 10,000 Vietnamese with airplanes, with air power. So we focus on the atrocities, but, you know, what you see is this entire attack based on these, you know, real violations of war. There were people who were accusing the UN of violations of international law, of war crimes, of atrocities. There were citizens' tribunals led by the famed philosopher Bertrand Russell. American soldiers in a group called the Vietnam Veterans Against the War had winter soldier hearings where they went around the country letting people know what they had witnessed or what they had done in Vietnam. And then you see this, of course, in Israel as well. The United States got closer to Israel after 1967. American aid to Israel was clearly significant from the start, but fairly temperate, relatively. So from the creation of Israel until 1959, like the first decade of its existence, the U.S. sent $650 million to Israel, and only a small percentage of that was considered military aid. In the 1960s, that increased to $834 million, and about 30% was military aid. But by the 1970s, you see this massive growth in it, up to over $16 billion, and over 70% of that is considered military aid, and then it obviously grows from there. So the United States is also making this massive economic, financial commitment to both Israel and Vietnam to try to defeat both the Viet Minh, Viet Cong, National Liberation Front, and the forces of liberation inside Palestine, right? One thing I always point out here, because I think it's important, is that Jimmy Carter had a big role in this too. Carter, you know, did amazing things after he left the White House. I think very admirable. As president, Carter was a friend, a real good friend to Israel, American aid. There are two major spikes in that era. You have aid, which goes up, but in 1973, there's a huge spike, right, because of the Ramadan-Yom Kippur War. And then in 1979, there's another huge spike because of the Iranian Revolution and the oil embargo. Carter is responsible for that. Carter quadrupled military aid to Israel in 1979. He also fired his representative to the United Nations, Andrew Young, because Young had met against orders with Yasser Arafat and other PLO representatives at the United Nations. So this is also, importantly, a bipartisan movement, right? And I have all kinds of data on American support of Israel. I'm sure you're familiar with it already. I just discovered this recently, so I thought it would be interesting to mention it because I myself had never even thought to look into this. But there was an intersection. There were some intersections between Vietnam and Israel itself. In 1963, Israel floated the idea of recognizing South Vietnam. South Vietnam, the U.S. had recognized South Vietnam in 1955. Israel suggested to the U.S. as a show of support that it would recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam at the U.N. And the United States said no, because, and this is an important issue at the time, the U.S. was afraid that if Israel was linked to South Vietnam, it would alienate liberal Jewish voters in the United States. And that became really an important issue throughout the duration of the war. This idea that most American Jews were very liberal and many already were starting to question Vietnam. And they obviously weren't going to question Israel. But if Israel were linked to this U.S. war in Vietnam, then that would be problematic. On the other side, the North Vietnamese did recognize the PLO in 1968. So there's already a link. But the one in with Israel and South Vietnam, I found really quite interesting. Israel did play a role in the Vietnam War. Not a big one, but it did provide some fairly limited military advisors and training. And a lot of this is symbolic. It's a way of saying to the U.S., you know, we're with you. And it was, I think to some degree, it's a way of saying thank you for what you've given us. But military advisors and training were important, especially in areas of counterinsurgency and special operations, which became a huge industry. And it still is, right? In the 80s, Israel was very active in these areas in Central America, where the United States was trying to overthrow or stop these liberation movements like Guatemala and Salvador and Nicaragua. And so Israel had a huge role. They would often set up the internal security apparatuses in these places. Israel provided some munitions and equipment, shared some intelligence, gave them some legitimacy with diplomatic relations. The U.S. rejected Israel recognition of South Vietnam in 1963. However, a couple years later, in 1965, the United States significantly increased its role in Vietnam. It was a massive escalation of the war. The war wasn't going well at all. It was never going well. And so in 1965, the United States actually reached out to Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, and asked if Israel could take a bigger role in Vietnam. They wanted more assistance. This time, it was Israel which was reluctant. By 1965, Israel believed it had gained more international credibility and legitimacy and didn't need that association with the U.S. the way it had before. Lyndon Johnson, the president, wrote to Levi Eshkol that if Israel supported Saigon, it would give a clear signal to the world of Israel's support for resistance to aggression in Vietnam. But the Israelis at the time didn't do it. They didn't think it was in their best interest. Israel began meeting with Vietnamese officials to discuss what kind of support they might give or what they might need. They did seek, South Vietnam began to seek Israeli recognition in 1965. But this time, in a flip, Levi Eshkol said that he couldn't do it because if Israel was going to recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, then would also have to recognize North Vietnam, which really pissed the United States off. Dean Rusk and others were very angry, essentially, like, after all we've done for you and you can't even do this. The other piece where I saw an intersection occurred in 1969 after Golda Meir became prime minister. In 1969, Richard Nixon gave his famous silent majority speech. He said, yeah, there's people out in the streets opposing the war, but most Americans don't. The silent majority supports us. Golda Meir sent him a note congratulating him, saying, what a great act of courage. Blah, blah, blah. The note was leaked. And inside Israel, it caused a firestorm. There was a kind of a pro-American paper named Mariv, and they attacked Meir for supporting Nixon. So clearly, public opinion in both Israel and among liberal Jews in the United States was anti-Vietnam War. Inside Israel, after Meir's message to Nixon was leaked, a rabbi named Balfour Brickner, gotta love it, you name your kid Balfour. So it says a lot, right? You know where what he's going to do, right? But he was a director of interfaith activities for Reform Judaism, said, Golda Meir has driven a wedge between herself and the liberal intellectual Jews of America who sought no conflict and supporting Israel's struggle while opposing the unjust, unwise war in Vietnam. He said that Meir reaching out to Nixon would alienate many of Israel's friends and America's academic community. How quaint they cared about what professors thought back then, because no one's asking me my opinion on anything right now, right? It would alienate liberal Protestants and Catholics and the clergy and among politically active young people with liberal inclination. Both of these countries, then, both of these situations are part of this global anti-colonial movement for national liberation, and they're getting the same response, and that's important. It's just going on all over the place. It's also interesting because one of my side gigs, I call it, is I am often at war with Oliver Stone's people over the Kennedy assassination. The assassination itself I don't care about, but their basic argument is that Kennedy was a man of peace and he was going to change the world and he was going to get out of the Vietnam War. One of the things they cite is that Kennedy stood up to Israel. I'm still not seeing that. And I actually look at all the documents. I don't like look at vignettes like they do. The United States took basically the same approach to events in Palestine. The PLO was immediately labeled a terrorist organization. Aid increased to governments in that region. As I said, as part of this regional arrangement as well, right? And in both places, you also saw regional wars. Who knows what Gaza will look like going forward, right? But it's really a terrifying thought. Vietnam, again, though, as I point out, was fortunate in that it could get outside support from places like, the Soviet Union and China. The axis of resistance, the so-called active resistance, is very different, right? It does have a level of involvement, you know, in supporting the fights, but nowhere near what countries like, the Soviet Union or China would, right? The United States could go after Laos and Cambodia, but it's not going to go after the Soviet Union and China. And in fact, Nixon creates a detente specifically with the Soviet Union and China. The United States understood Vietnam was a bad idea and began to look for outlets after Nixon took over, especially Kissinger in 1970, said this is going to be the year of Europe and we're going to reach out to the Europeans because Vietnam is a bad idea. There's nothing similar to that now, right, where everybody just doubles down on what is already clearly a genocide, right? Another part that's important, but again, plays out differently, is global condemnation. By the later 1960s, the U.S. was really getting an earful from its allies. And I've seen documents on that from the British, from the French and others saying, you're destroying the alliance. You are giving the Soviet Union massive propaganda victories. You're destroying the global economy, which is a real issue with these wars, right? So they're encouraging the United States to get out of Vietnam or to delay it or to de-escalate or whatever. Eventually, the U.S. does. I respect the hell out of the anti-war movement. I would argue the United States finally de-escalates in Vietnam because the global economy requires it. And I've often wondered like how that will play out today because we're obviously in a time of real precarious economic conditions. So far today, those major allies continue to support the United States, places like the UK and Germany. Now, lately, we've seen what I would still call more or less performative changes in that. And I don't know how those are going to play out, but they tend to be, you know, kind of smaller. You see these statements coming out of places like the UK or Italy or Spain. And that, I think, eventually is really going to be crucial by itself, it's very difficult to defeat the empire, especially an empire like the United States directly in Vietnam, where it's just, you know, the United States dropped 4.6 million tons in a place the size of New Mexico. The United States is subsidizing it, but it has the same effect today. Another thing that I think is important is that we've seen an abandonment of what used to be called soft power. Not that I'm a proponent of soft power, but they don't even try that anymore. They immediately go straight to the most violent responses possible. This is also true of resistance at home. The anti-war movement is now met with violent and immediate resistance. There's no assumption. I mean, Trump does not differentiate between like nonviolent or violent protest or whatever, right? They're all to be met the same way, right? And we obviously saw that. I know we had an event with the directors of the encampments. One thing that struck me, like just to take Colombia for an example, in 1968, when SDS occupied Hamilton Hall because of the Vietnam War, they actually went into the building and took over several offices. They took over the dean's office, the provost's office. It took a week for the Columbia administration to bring in the police. And the removal, you know, they roughed them up and stuff. But now it's immediate. You know, it's immediate and it's rough. The other part, though, that I think is somewhat hopeful is it did take a long time in Vietnam. You know, Noam Chomsky and others have said the first actions they ever saw didn't occur until like around 1965 when the war was well underway. Now it's immediate. It's immediate, right? On campuses, in communities, and elsewhere. So that may be some cause for hope. Let me kind of just, you know, to sum up, I think Gaza is an example of the lessons of Vietnam, but I think a lot of it is that the ruling class has learned those lessons too. And they're doing things differently. They're doing things immediate. They're hitting with a level of force that they hadn't used before. The ideas are the same. The goal is the same, to defeat liberation movements. These movements could be called communist. They could be called terrorists. In Vietnam, the rationale for opposing them was, or opposing anti-war people, was that they were communists or they were communist dupes. Today, calling somebody Hamas fills the same role, right? In 1969, you know, Ho Chi Minh is the new Hitler. They're a bunch of terrorists. Today, it's Hamas, right? It's an old playbook, and they've learned well from it. So I think understanding, I'm not sure how much it helps nowadays, because let's face it, it's a fairly bleak situation. But I think understanding America's long-time resistance to movements like this and the lengths to which it will go to defeat these movements, often very violent means, right, is worth knowing. But within that, I do think that there are ways that these people who I really admire the hell out of, right, these groups who are out there. It's interesting not to single out JVP, who I think does great stuff. I don't want to like shortchange Palestinians resisting as well. But JVP often reminds me of a very important group in the Vietnam era, VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, because veterans had a particular kind of credibility and legitimacy. They were in the war. And I think JVP kind of has that, too, which is why you see the media pay so much attention to them. It makes it a little bit harder, I think. You know, it wasn't that easy in the 60s to say, oh, those guys are a bunch of communists. They're veterans. They were fighting in Vietnam. And in the same way, it's a little harder, I guess, to say that JVP is anti-Semitic. I want to end with a poem by Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was a great poet. And I always like this one because it kind of shows the sense of kind of hope that he had. He wrote this when he was under arrest. But as he was in prison, he wrote, "Being chained is a luxury to compete for. The chained have somewhere to sleep. The unchained haven't. The state treats me to its rice. I lodge in its palaces. Its guards take turns escorting me. Really, the honor is too great." Ho wrote that at a very bleak and dark moment in Vietnamese history. He was imprisoned. The Viet Minh were fighting against the French and the Japanese, and then eventually the French again and the Americans. And yet he saw this kind of hope, this sense of light. And it's very hard to find nowadays, right? So I think it's better to end on this note that even in the midst of the Vietnamese Revolution, Ho was in jail. Van Nguyen Giáp was in jail. French authorities killed General Giáp's wife. There were massive, large-scale killings of Viet Minh and Viet Minh supporters, or people who even just like were accused of being Viet Minh, right? Ho still had that idea that he could be whimsical and talk about it and talk about what he called a Vietnam 10 times more beautiful. And I think people today who see, you know, a free Palestine in the future are doing the same thing. And I think that's really critical. So thank you again, and all of you. And I really appreciate this.
You were just listening to Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now. He spoke in Washington, D.C. in mid-June 2025. Robert Bezanko is an award-winning scholar and a professor emeritus in history at the University of Houston. He's co-host of the Green and Red podcast. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now, and for Rashid Khalidi's classic book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ricci is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Fairuz singing in Arabic, Senarjiu Yoman, One Day We Will Return.
Published our report analyzing Israel's conduct in the Gaza Strip pursuant to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. The commission concluded that Israel has committed genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza and that it is continuing with that genocide. Every day that passes, the killings and the starvation of the Palestinians continue. The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear as we continue to witness the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza. The commission finds it is genocide. The commission concludes that statements made by Israeli authorities are direct evidence of genocidal intent.
That's Navi Pillay, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Navi Pillay, Chris Sidoti, and Irene Khan on Israel's genocide in Gaza, the UN report. In mid-September, the UN issued a report stating that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Israel vehemently denies the charge. Genocide is the crime of crimes. It's a highly charged and loaded word. To verify it requires clear and unambiguous evidence. The term was coined by the Polish-Jewish lawyer Raphael Lemkin. The term genocide combines the Greek prefix genos, which means race or tribe, with the Latin suffix side, killing. Lemkin was aware of the Armenian genocide carried out by the Turks earlier in the 20th century. During the Holocaust, he lost many family members. Lemkin and others were responsible for the Genocide Convention, which was passed unanimously by the UN in 1948. In addition to the recently released UN report, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, as well as two prominent Israeli rights organizations, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and other groups, declared that Israel's military actions in Gaza constitute genocide. We begin this program with Irene Khan. She's followed by Navi Pillay and Chris Sidoti. The moderator is Todd Pittman, Media Advisor, UN Human Rights Office. They spoke at the UN in Geneva in mid-September. Irene Khan is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Navi Pillay is Chair of the UN Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. Chris Sidoti is a member of the UN Independent Commission. And now, Irene Khan.
Gaza has become the deadliest conflict ever for journalists. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than in both world wars, Vietnam War, wars in Yugoslavia, and the war in Afghanistan combined, according to one research institute. The UN number right now is 252, but that is, of course, likely to go up because every week we hear news of more killings. In August alone, 9 journalists were killed in 3 horrific, bloody incidents, as you may remember. Many of these 252 journalists have been targeted, by which we mean deliberately picked out and killed because of the work that they are doing to expose the atrocities, the crimes, the genocide on the ground. Let me spend 1 minute on the strategy that Israel seems to have developed, where they will first delegitimize and discredit a journalist. Smear campaigns are started, accusing the journalists of being terrorist supporters or terrorists themselves, and then they are killed. So it is not just killing journalists, but killing. The attempt is being very clearly made here to kill the story, because local journalists in Gaza today are carrying the brunt of that killing spree, because they are the ones, only ones who are there. Gaza, what is happening in Gaza is extremely unusual in that I cannot recall another situation where a member state of the United Nations has denied access to independent international media for a conflict, for atrocities, for the unfolding of genocide, and now genocide actually happening. We have not seen in any other country a situation like that happening, where international media are being denied independent access. The burden then falls on the local journalists who are being picked out, as I mentioned, labeled as terrorists and killed. Journalism is not terrorism. Journalism is not a crime. Journalists are civilians under international humanitarian law and therefore protected like other civilians. However, journalists, because of the nature of their war, have to go where the fighting is. They cannot flee away from the fighting, and they are being then deliberately picked out and killed. International media have been denied access. Al Jazeera has been actually banned from even operating in the West Bank or in Israel itself. As Francesca Albanese, as you know, has written about the anatomy of genocide and the economy of genocide, and I would say that the story of the way in which journalists are being killed, silenced, killing journalists, murdered, in fact, is the cover-up of genocide, because these local journalists are the main source for news right now from the ground up. And if they can be stopped, if the information that is leaking out to the world can be stopped somehow, the Israeli Defense Forces believe that they can continue to do what they are doing with impunity. And that actually is the critical word here, impunity. Israel has never been held accountable. Israel has never allowed independent investigation of a single killing of a journalist ever in the Palestinian occupied territories. We have cases going back 20 years that have not ever been investigated internationally. And that, of course, has created this environment of permissibility in which the Israeli Defense Forces can do what they want to destroy those who are daring to expose the truth on the ground. And that, to me, is a big tragedy, certainly for the journalists themselves, certainly for the genocide in Gaza, but I think for media freedom around the world, a terrible precedent here is being made. And those countries that champion media freedom, those who speak about independent media, I hold them responsible at this stage. They must bring pressure to bear on Israel to allow independent investigation of the killings, to allow international access to international independent media. The very presence of international independent media will give some degree of protection to local journalists who are out there working alone, and of course, to stop the killing itself. Without journalists, we know that this story will never be complete. The information will be very difficult to get. Already, local journalists are suffering the same conditions like the rest of the population, looking for food, water, shelter. They've had family members killed, and yet they continue. Many of them continue very bravely to report. But how long can that can go on happening? In fact, in my last press release, the title was "States Must Stop Israel Before All Journalists in Gaza Are Silenced." And that is what I fear. I hope very much that you will speak up for those in your own community, journalists in your own professional community, speak up loud and clear that this must come to an end and Israel must be held accountable. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us at this press conference here in Geneva with the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. The commission is here to share with you the findings of their latest report to the Human Rights Council and answer any questions you may have about that report on the situation in Gaza. We'll start today with an opening statement by the chair, Ms. Navi Pillay, then we'll open the floor to your questions. Thank you.
Today we published our report analyzing Israel's conduct in the Gaza Strip, a strip pursuant to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. The Commission concluded that Israel has committed genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza and that it is continuing with that genocide. It is now almost 2 years since Israel launched its military campaign in the Gaza Strip in October 2023. This has been the most ruthless, prolonged, and widespread attack against the Palestinian people since 1948. Every day that passes, the killings and the starvation of the Palestinians continue. On 22nd August, the Famine Review Committee determined that famine is currently occurring in Gaza Governorate. At the time, the committee had projected famine thresholds to be crossed in Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis Governorates in the coming weeks. The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear as we continue to witness the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza. The Commission finds it is genocide. In our report, the Commission found that the Israeli authorities and Israeli security forces committed and are continuing to commit the following underlying acts of genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. One, killing members of the group. Two, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. 3, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and 4, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. On the specific intent of genocide, the Commission concludes that statements made by Israeli authorities are direct evidence of genocidal intent. The Commission also concludes that the pattern of conduct is circumstantial evidence for genocidal intent, and that genocidal intent was the only reasonable inference that could be drawn from a totality of the evidence. Therefore, the Commission concludes that the Israeli authorities and Israeli security forces have the genocidal intent to destroy, in whole or in part, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Commission finds that the Israeli political and military leaders are agents of the State of Israel. Therefore, their acts are attributable to the State of Israel. The Commission therefore concludes that the State of Israel bears responsibility for the failure to prevent genocide, for the commission of genocide, and for the failure to punish genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. On incitement to genocide, the Commission concludes that many Israeli political and military leaders, including President Isaac Herzog, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and then Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, had incited the commission of genocide, and that Israeli authorities have failed to take action against them to punish this incitement. This report is the result of almost 2 years of work. The Commission began its investigation immediately on 7th October 2023 and has documented more than 16,000 pieces of evidentiary materials to date. The Commission has published 3 mandated reports and 3 thematic papers since 7th October 2023. And our findings in this report are based on the factual findings contained in all the reports that we had published since 7th October 23, as well as the findings from our upcoming mandated report to the General Assembly in October 2025. The analysis contained in this report relates solely to the determination of genocide in the Gaza Strip between October 2023 and July 2025. The Commission nevertheless raises the serious concern that the specific intent to destroy the Palestinians as a whole is guiding Israel in its operations in the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory, that is, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. It is also important to note that the events in Gaza since 7th October 2023 have not occurred in isolation. They were preceded by decades of unlawful occupation and repression under an ideology requiring the removal of the Palestinian population from their lands and their replacement. We recommend all member states, especially those with influence over Israel, to effect an immediate halt to the killing and harming of civilians in Gaza, to guarantee humanitarian access to Gaza, and to prevent further destruction of life and suspend arms transfers or financial assistance that could contribute to further genocidal acts. The Genocide Convention was born out of humanity's darkest chapters. Today, we witness in real time how the promise of never again is broken and tested in the eyes of the world. The ongoing genocide in Gaza is a moral outrage and a legal emergency. Member states must act now. There is no need to wait for the International Court of Justice to declare it a genocide. All states are obligated to use whatever means within its power to prevent the commission of genocide. And so we urge member states to ensure accountability for any crimes that have been committed and prevent further crimes from being committed, not just in Gaza, but the entire occupied Palestinian territory. So that's the end of my statement. And my colleague Chris Sidoti and I are here to respond to your questions, if any. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pele. Now we'll open the floor to questions for the chair and the fellow commissioner, Chris Sidoti. We'll start on the right side. Please identify yourself and the media outlet that you work for.
Laurent Ciro, Swiss News Agency. Thanks for the press conference. You mentioned four out of five categories, components of genocide whose conditions are fulfilled in that case. Could you say why the fifth one has not been met?
The fifth category of genocidal act is the transfer of children from one group to another group. And the reason why that was not established is because we have no evidence of it. This has been an issue in other situations. It is particularly a much debated issue in relation to the Russia-Ukraine dispute, where Ukrainian children were taken to Russia. But we have no evidence that that category five, has arisen in the case of Gaza or the West Bank.
Thank you. Now we'll go again at the front row. Jamie Keaton from the Associated Press, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Madame Pile, and hi, Mr. Sidoti. Thank you for your report. I have two questions. The first is the Israeli Foreign Ministry today decried a distorted and false report and said that three individuals, so referring to the Commission of Inquiry, three individuals serving as Hamas proxies notorious for their openly anti-Semitic positions. Could you please comment on that? Your response. And then my second question is, you talk about countries need to act. There has been a widespread condemnation across the world, not just from advocacy groups, but also governments and others. It seems to me that there's a number of countries that have been, let's say, more reticent to condemn Israel's behavior. I'm thinking particularly the United States and Germany. Could you please give us your appeal directly to those two countries? Because you're saying countries in general, but could you be specific to those two countries, please?
Can I respond? I've got the chair's permission, Jamie, to answer your first question. These reports should be taken seriously, but honestly, the Israeli responses are becoming so boring. You know, they say the same thing every time. They're producing the responses by ChatGPT these days, and they spend so much money in the foreign ministry on propaganda, you'd think that they would actually come up with something original. I would want them to engage with the evidence, but they never engage with the evidence. They put the report into ChatGPT, and then they put out the standard response. So no one takes it seriously, and Jamie, you shouldn't either.
You know, this is 2 years' work on our part, painstakingly gathering the facts. You know, we're very aware that we have a mandate you can't hear me? All right. So we have a mandate that requires us to share this information to judicial institutions, and we have not only the ICC, but national judiciaries. There was one request. And so we are very, very careful to ensure that we personally investigate and verify every fact here. We even quote the figures released by Israel. And I was labeled anti-Semitic only when I took over as chair of this commission. I served 6 years as High Commissioner for Human Rights, and Israel invited me, the only High Commissioner, to go on a mission to Israel. And they mentioned the balance with which I come in. So I'm sorry to bring in the personal element, but I, as Chris said, I wish they'll tell us where we went wrong on these facts. Or just cooperate with us if they had done any investigations. That's on the one. Yeah, I take your point about naming states. You know, we had two additional mandates given to us by the Human Rights Council 2 years ago, but we never received resources for them. Our staff, you know, It's a small number of staff overworking. We're concerned about their health, in fact. So we couldn't deliver on those two, one of which was to produce a report on the transfer of military equipment by states. We started working on this. And so that's why we're not ready to name any states just yet. But we will get there once we get our resources. Thank you for that.
Thank you. In the front row, please go ahead.
I'm Mohamed Alfinich from Algat TV. According to your report, so clearly Israel commit genocide. Can you please tell us, like those like headlines you can mention as Israel commit genocide? Another thing, we've been hearing for the last 2 years, some member of state, they said Israel it might commit genocide. After your report, do you think now the things are clear about genocide in Gaza?
In the beginning, for instance, we were the first to denounce and condemn the Hamas attacks that took place on 7th October, and we named them as crimes against humanity, violations of international humanitarian law. And that's where we're thinking, because this is a Human Rights Council, that's the laws they provide. Until we see the evidence, like everybody else is watching the television and seeing it in real life. So it's the facts that moved us to investigate. We gather all the facts firstly, assess, verify, and then we see where the facts take us. Now, the law on genocide, how we found the specific intent by connecting the pattern of the acts as well as statements by the leaders. We've enumerated the statements. They're very explicit on treating all Palestinians as Hamas operatives. So I'll have... Chris, would you like to do the second half of the question on the law itself?
Yeah. Nadi mentioned the four categories of genocidal act that we found, and we indicated in the opening statement what those four categories are. But your question is well placed, because we didn't go into the detail that underlay our findings in those areas. And we didn't in our statement today, because these facts are so well known. We have recited them in great length in our report. Our report, you've seen it, runs out around 80 pages in length. But the facts are 60,000, 65,000 dead, at least, of whom at least 20,000 are children. These deaths are not accidents. They are not collateral damage. They are the direct consequence of a military strategy of saturation bombing and scorched earth when it comes to the infrastructure of Gaza and the people of Gaza. The numbers that are seriously, physically or mentally injured are enormous, and that's the second category. We are told, we haven't done comparisons with other wars, but we are told that the number of children that have had one or both legs and arms amputated is greater than in any other conflict this century. Certainly we know the number of children who have lost one or both parent. The trauma, the psychological trauma for children will last their whole lives. That's mental harm. The physical injury to people, the amputations, the illnesses, the compounding of disease because of a lack of medical treatment. The consequences of starvation, a child who is malnourished is affected for the rest of the child's life. Serious physical and mental harm. The destruction of conditions of life. We didn't examine the destruction of the residential towers last weekend. Of course, our report was finished before that. But that was just the culmination of what we did find, and that is the wholesale destruction of the infrastructure of Gaza. Residences, homes, hospitals, universities, schools, museums, churches, mosques, archaeological sites, roads, agricultural facilities, the fishing industry. Our reports over 2 years have built the full picture of the extent of the destruction. And the destruction is such added in particular to the starvation policies, that the conditions of life in Gaza are unsupportable. The third category of genocidal act. And we, for the first time in a UN report, also examined the question of reproductive violence. And our report, published in March this year, dealt, amongst other things, with the destruction of fertility clinics and fertility facilities in Gaza, affecting the continuity of the Gaza population, the fourth category of genocidal act. So we have built our report on the basis of our own investigations. But we haven't taken second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand information. We haven't relied on other people's reports. We've relied on eyewitnesses, on digital evidence, photographic and video, satellite technology. We particularly have been assisted by the evidence of foreign medical workers who spent time in Gaza. They're not secondary evidence or hearsay evidence. They told us what they actually saw. And it's because of our own investigations that we came to the conclusions that we did. And that's the basis of the last part of your question. Why now? Why now? Because now, after painstakingly collected all of this evidence, now we are able to do what lawyers do. Collect evidence, find facts, apply the law. And this report is our conclusions.
Thank you. Now we'll go to the back and then we'll come back up. Thanks.
Thank you. Moussa Asi, Al Mayadeen TV. My question concerning the term of genocide, you used this term maybe for the first one. If this term will have an impact of the work of International Court of Justice, because the International Court of Justice has not fully used this term till now, and the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Geneva has not used this term till now, if there is an impact of those entities. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I've been asked already whether, had I been the High Commissioner still, I would have reacted as High Commissioner Volker has, and I probably would have. I also believed you have to wait for a court to determine whether genocide has occurred. That's what I used to I told the team at the beginning, that that's why we don't examine genocide immediately. Because, as you know, I was a judge on the panel on the Rwanda tribunal that delivered the world's first judgment on genocide. I know how carefully you have to look for evidence to support that special intention to destroy a group in whole or in part. However, serving on this commission, as we said, we looked at the facts. And that means a two-year work. And the High Commissioner Volker doesn't have the benefit of this report until today. Now, why did I learn that genocide must be addressed? It's because how the Genocide Convention makes imposes an obligation on states to prevent and punish genocide. Now, how will they do that if we all sit and wait for some court, if ever, to determine genocide has occurred? And therefore, we must look at the facts, look at the policy statements made by political leaders. We apply the two. And the most important statement we have so far is the order of the ICJ that there is plausible reason that there's a risk of genocide being committed. So that's the most authoritative statement to states and to all of us to examine this crime.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to the front row and then we'll move back.
Thank you very much, Abdullah Imasi from Al Arabi TV. Thanks for this insightful report and well-documented report. Even the Israelis are are not happy with it. As you always, like a moment ago, the Israeli ambassador said that this report is full of lie and allegation against Israel. Talking about Israeli officials, in your report, you named Herzog, Netanyahu, and Gallant for incitement. Now, my question is, what action should state take after this report? And my second question is, like, as a follow-up of my colleague from the EP, what single binding step must government take within 30 days under the Genocide Convention? Thank you very much.
So far as those named as having been responsible for the incitement of genocide, we have made a recommendation to the International Criminal Court that examine the evidence in relation to their statements and consider whether they should be prosecuted. That is a matter for the court. I should add that we have focused on the three of the top officials responsible for this area, but there are many, many statements by Israeli political and civilian leaders that incite genocide, and also by others, including some media commentators in Israel that have been inciting genocide. So we just looked at the tip of the iceberg, and that is those at the very top of the command pyramid within Israeli society. The incitement to genocide is a separate standalone crime under the Rome Statute. And that's what we're focused on, that crime of incitement in naming them at the top of the pyramid of command. So it's up to the court, but we have provided the evidence in our report and we've made a recommendation to the court, and we will see what action the court takes.
Okay, thank you. Second row, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Jeremy Lange for the French Public Radio. Kind of a follow-up question to my colleagues' previous ones. Another way to ask you for that is, are you hoping that from now on, the UN, the Secretary General, the High Commissioner, will use the word genocide and not acts of genocide? And same thing for the state parties.